.com. It's presented by Katie Derham.
Good evening and welcome to the Royal Albert Hall for a proms debut by a venerable American orchestra, the St. Louis Symphony. They're kicking off their first European tour in more than a decade, and I have to say there were lots of excited American voices backstage today, not least that of their much-loved music director, David Robertson. He's no stranger to the Proms, of course. It's his 20th appearance tonight, but we most often see him at the helm of the BBC Symphony Orchestra. Tonight, though, he's thrilled to be showcasing his American family with a rich and varied programme which includes Beethoven, the violin concerto, Brahms, Schoenberg and Gershwin.
Well, the musicians are all really pumped up and very excited to be here. Just the Royal Albert Hall, of course, is a legendary place and everyone knows the Brahms concerts, and so the excitement of starting our tour off by performing at the BBC Proms can't really be equaled by anything else. Not that Berlin, Lucerne, and Paris are going to be a letdown, but at the same time, it's nice to start on a really high note. The St. Louis Symphony is one of the warmest groups that I know, and probably the best way that I can describe their personality in musical terms is that they seem to reach right for the stuff of what the meaning of the music is about. The program is about this correspondence between musical personalities. And this, to me, makes sense for an American orchestra to do, because we are about this combination of the old. We are the second oldest orchestra in the country, formed in 1880, and the new, and the cross communication between different cultures, whether European, American, or Asian.
David Robertson there. So we are going to start with Brahms, the Tragic Overture. Written at the same time as the very cheery academic festival overture, it couldn't be more different in tone. The title may be non-committal, but it's thought to have originated in a project to stage Goethe's Faust. You don't need to know that story, though, to hear a tale of human defiance against adverse fate. Well, the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra are on stage under their concertmaster, David Halen. And they're standing now to welcome their music director, David Robertson, to lead them in a performance of Brahms's Tragic Overture.
Thank you.
Brahms's tragic overture performed here at the Proms for the very first time by the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra, conducted by their musical director since 2005, David Robertson. Wonderful way to get their debut concert off and running. The warmth with which this orchestra and their conductor feel for each other is palpable. Dave has just come back on to take another bow and has brought them to their feet in front of this very appreciative sellout crowd here at the Royal Albert Hall. Well, from Brahms to the composer he revered and who he never felt he could really compare himself with, Beethoven. We're going to hear the violin concerto, played by Christian Tetzlaff. It was written in 1806, and with it he set a standard by which all subsequent violin concertos were measured. It might be one of the best-known works in the repertoire, with its air of threatened innocence in the first movement, then the prayer-like second movement, and the raucous dancing third. As Christian told me earlier, though, it's the timpani you have to listen out for, setting the tone from the very first bars, even through to the cadenza.
The timpani and the motive of the timpani, which gets passed through all instruments, is continuously there. So it's no wonder that Beethoven incorporated it in his cadenza, which he wrote for piano. When he made the piece into a piano concerto, he wrote a cadenza and I just transcribed it. It goes off into almost crazy direction. He quotes the last movement in this cadenza, and after the fast march of the cadenza, he goes back into the ground speed of the movement and sets the mood and tempo for the beautiful ending of this movement.
It's very effective.
That's good. Yeah, I can't take any credit for it.
Well, Christian has often played with the St. Louis Symphony, and David Robertson, when I spoke to him earlier, was full of praise for his playing.
When Christian Tetzlaff plays a piece of music, he plays the piece of music, and he happens to play that piece of music on a violin. And so the thing that's really fascinating is that it is a violin concerto, but it is more about what is going on in the music than showing off the concerto itself.
The conductor tonight waxing lyrical about the soloist Christian Tetzlaff. Well, we heard David earlier talk about this program that he's put together for the prom tonight, showing the common links between composers who on paper at least seem perhaps a little unconnected, although of course the link between Brahms and Beethoven has been very well documented. Brahms lived for years in the shadow of Beethoven. He had what can only be described as an inferiority complex. It rendered him completely unable to even attempt to write a symphony for years and years. In the end, of course, the people of Vienna put them on equal pedestals, burying Brahms between the tombs of Beethoven and of Schubert. Well, as you can hear, the orchestra are retuning briefly as they prepare to perform Beethoven's violin concerto. We'll be awaiting the arrival of Christian Tetzlaff and David Robertson to the stage very soon. This is the first tour that the St. Louis Symphony have taken to Europe, and I think it's 14 years, and as I mentioned earlier, they are extremely excited. I have to say, I think they were even more pleased that the sun was shining for them in London. So, the mood, very happy indeed. But here come Christian Tetzlaff and David Robertson to perform Beethoven's great violin concerto.
Thank you. Thank you.
an utterly transporting performance of Beethoven's Violin Concerto by Christian Tetzlaff, who's being applauded by conductor David Robertson and by the entire orchestra, the St. Louis Symphony, here for the first time at the Proms. The third time that Christian has played the Beethoven Violin Concerto here at the Proms. He still has some way to go before beating the record set by Ida Haendel, who played it 15 times between 1937 and 1988. Back on stage, just listen to the cheers.
You know, it sounds so obvious to say that's such a difficult, challenging piece, but you know, it's so hard that it took more than 50 years until it became a regular part of the violin soloist repertoire. People just couldn't play it.
And the timpanist getting special mention by David Robertson there. We heard, of course, how crucial he is to the whole piece in that interview with Christian Tetzlaff earlier. And a fine example of what David Robertson was saying earlier about how this orchestra play as a single unit. They know Christian Tetzlaff, they love playing with him, but they obviously also love playing for David Robertson. David now bringing different sections of the orchestra to their feet. The woodwinds and now all the strings. And Thomas Stubbs, the timpanist, getting another mention. Well, I wonder if Christian is listening to that. He's coming back on stage now with David Robertson. But David is taking a seat. I think we could be in for an encore. Well, isn't that something? Christian Tetzlaff,
just played the Beethoven Violin Concerto, and then, as an encore, just gave us just a little bit of solo Bach. The Partita in C major, that was the Allegro Assai. Warmly appreciated by the crowd here at the Royal Albert Hall, and bringing the first half of tonight's prom to an end. The St. Louis Symphony warmly applauding Christian as he comes back to take off his sixth or seventh, I've lost count, bow here at the Royal Albert Hall. Well, as September begins, let's hope we're in for a glorious autumn, but frankly, who knows what the weather will be doing. One man who thinks he does know, though, is David King. For the past 50 years, David has been walking the fields and flood meadows close to his home in Kent, spotting the signs that help him give weather forecasts based not on science, but on nature. He now claims he can predict 9 months in advance with 90% accuracy. David Bramwell went to find out just how he goes about it.
I'm in a car park in Edenbridge in Kent to meet a gentleman called David King, who claims to be the Sherlock Holmes of the weather world. I don't know if I'm appropriately dressed for the weather today. I've just got a jacket on, no waterproofs, and it was looking pretty ominous earlier on, quite heavy grey clouds overhead. But according to the app on my phone, at least, the weather's going to be fine today, no rain. But a man who claims to have 90% accuracy in reading of the weather is David, and he doesn't do this through scientific equipment or using the information from the Met Office. He does this by divining nature, by reading the details of the natural world around him. And we're going to go on a little walk in a minute, and we're going to see if we can uncover some of the secrets of weather reading from David himself.
Outbreaks of rain will spread eastwards across South Wales and southern England.
Rather cloudy, though, in the south of the UK, with light winds, bright spells and showers in England.
Elsewhere, it'll be cloudier with scattered thundery showers, especially in the south.
I don't care what the weatherman says. When the weatherman says it's raining, you'll never hear me complaining. I'm certain the sun will shine.
By examining the details of nature, David claims he can predict the weather up to 9 months in advance.
Hello,
I'm David.
Nice to meet you.
Pleased to meet you, David.
I'm David as well.
Would you like a cup of tea? There's a weather station in the garden, so I do the proper stuff as well, and that goes down every day to the Met Office. But I also do the silly stuff, and the Met Office go mad. I've told them it's going to rain Christmas Day. It's going to what? I said, to rain Christmas Day. How do you know? I said, well, nature told me.
Is this a walk you do every day?
Yes, every day. And it's about a 3 square mile radius. But we've just had harvest time for the hay. So whereas all the deer and the partridge and the pheasants used to sit in the hay, well, they've had it now because we've cut all the hay.
What's a typical day for you, David?
Open the doors, get up about 5. Open the front door, smell the air. That tells you what day's going to do, nearly always. And then Hoover, then internet. Download the weather for the previous day, do all my weather stats, and by 8 o'clock I'm up and ready to go.
So between 5 and 8 in the morning, those are the hours when you do your predictions.
And then I will come back again then in the evening, because I'll record the weather 5 times a day, year in, year out. So we're heading for the little bridge.
Do you have any competitors?
Well, I'm a member of COL, which is the Climatologist Observers Link, the foremost amateur climatologist club in the UK, and there's about 600-700 of us, and we all do this. We're all weather geeks. And I'm out for about 3 hours on the average. Depends how many times I get stopped, because the farmers love me, because I did a bulletin for them and said you've got in February, because the grass was growing on New Year's Day, you weren't going to get one hay harvest.
Is that an old folklore?
Yeah.
And how do you measure the grass growing in a day?
Well, you see it growing.
We sit and watch it, or?
No, if you walk across the fields every day, you can physically see the grass growing. Another one is, if the farmer looks out of his kitchen window on Christmas Day and sees the sun, a wonderful, this is what I'm going to show you, look, a wonderful fruit harvest. How about that then, eh?
There's an abundance of big green apples just hanging over a wall here.
18 apples, eh? Yeah, and so that is because the farmer, last Christmas Day, the sun shone for 2.5 hours. He looks out of his window through the orchard and saw the sun. Good fruit harvest, good grain harvest. Now, I'm sorry, you've got to climb over the gate there. Into a meadow beside the river. This is an old hedge on the left, and all these hedges here are the old boundary markers from 1100s, and all we're doing is walk across meadows. This is all green belt, so it'll never be built on. What tree is this?
I've no idea.
It's a hazel tree where you get nuts. Can you see any nuts?
No.
I'll show you. Here they are, look. Now, we have a problem this year. They're called cob nuts. And on the 20th is St. Philbert's Day, when they go and harvest these down in Kent, you see. But this year, because it's been so dry, you notice how easily that fell off. Now I'll show you something. When you open them, there's no meat inside.
Is that because of the drought?
Yes. We have an acute drought down here. Now, because we've got no nuts, the animals will depend on that. So nature, in its wisdom, says, well, I won't give you a hard winter. I will give you a mild winter. And that's why we've got a second crop of blackberries. First crop now, and the second crop, because we're not going to get any rain in November, that will feed the animals all the way through November, and the birds. Nature's way of compensating.
So in your worldview, there's an intelligence in nature that it...
Oh, yes. There's an advanced warning system which is working 6 to 9 months ahead. And all I'm doing is gathering that, interpreting it. Sometimes I get it wrong, but that's not because nature's got it wrong. It is because I've cocked up.
A lot of your observations and predictions are based on folklore sayings.
Yes.
Were you observing nature and then finding that your observations were backed up by ancient folklore, or were you reading the folklore and then looking for those things yourself?
50-50. And the way I broke this was to go to all the cattle markets, and there were loads of cattle markets in Kent, East Sussex and Surrey, and go and find the eponymous old boy of 70, weather-beaten face with a stick and a hat, and go up to him and sit down and say, "Sir, I need your help. I will buy you a pint if you will give me 1 hour telling me about weather lore." So over a period of 8 years, I did about 800 interviews. And they're all in longhand in big A4 books. And then I backed this up by records from Canterbury Cathedral, Rochester Cathedral, county record offices, parochial church records, local records, then hitting all the old bookshops, libraries, and then Mr. Gates came to my help and gave me Windows 3.1. And then, so I stuck it down in the database. But that's all right. I had somewhere in the region of 30,000 sayings.
You've ploughed through these and you've tried to decipher which are true and which are just superstition.
Yeah. And which are charlatan, which are rubbish.
So, I mean, one of the most common ones, one that I remember as a child, is if you see the cows lying down in the field, it means it's going to rain.
I go to lectures and with academics, and before we start, has anybody got a weather saying? They say, yes, when the cows lay down, it's going to rain. I say, I'm very sorry, madam. No, the cows laying down because their legs ache. And it breaks the ice.
And I suppose thinking back to the days when fishing was much more of an important industry in England, it was essential that fishermen were able to have a good sense of what the weather was going to be, because their lives were at risk.
I did fishermen, gamekeepers, thatchers, shepherds, cowmen, herdsmen, anybody that works on the land, because we're bombing beer, but you go to them and talk to them, and they're fountains of all knowledge. You see, so I can pass this on now. And you go to the scientists and they say, hocus pocus. You go to the farmers and they love me, there's a period of frost the 11th to the 15th of May. Down this way. They're called the Ice Maidens. And in 1991, they wiped out 65% of the whole of the French vine crop. That's how serious it is. So that is the time, mid-May, when all the fruit blossom is on the trees. So you can imagine, if you get a frost, you lose all your fruit. So I was able to tell them this year, don't worry about it. We're going to go round here in the road. I said, don't worry about it. There's going to be no frost. Are you sure? Yes, absolutely positive. So if I'm going to turn around and say it's a good fruit harvest, I've got to have four separate, independent, unconnected, but proven sayings to go together. And I'll say, you're going to get no frost. I'll take up a little bit further and show you an oak. Now the oak is, how to do, without any doubt, the most important tree there is in the countryside. I'll give you an example. If you put your hand in, just monoprickle, just put your hand in there.
Putting my hand into the prickles and trying to find something behind the oak tree.
There's an oak behind it, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, can you feel the wind in there?
Yes.
You see that those branches, if the branches are still, those leaves are still there on the 11th of November, that tells us we're going to have a severe winter because the birds sit on those branches and they're in the warmth and they're protected from the wind and they're protected from the rain and they're protected from the snow. So if the oak begins to lose its leaves early, you can say we're not going to have a very severe winter. And this year, even the oaks are beginning to lose their leaves early.
So if your belief system is around the idea of nature having an intelligence to self-regulate itself, how do you feel about global warming and environmental change? Do you think the Earth ultimately has the power to redress that?
I will admit that fossil fuels have something to do with it, but it doesn't affect what nature does and it does not affect my weather. There's a typical example of man's effect on nature. They've been along and flailed it, and that was full of teasels and burdock.
And is this an ancient hedgerow?
Yes, a very ancient hedgerow. This was full of blackberries and food for the animals for the winter. And you can see what man does. He just wipes it out completely.
And you use birdsong as well to interpret.
Yes, yes.
And predict the future weather.
Yes. Yes, not yesterday, the day before, the swifts disappeared. Now, they feed on the wing and they need insects, flying insects. And as soon as they disappear, you know, A, it's going to get cooler, and B, there's going to be not enough food for them. So it's going to get colder or wetter or both. And they disappeared day before yesterday. And it's the little things which tell you. We will go down the farm and I will see if there's any martins and see if they're going. They all flock on the wires and you'll get 300-400 all sitting there. And they discuss the route. Are we going via Gibraltar? Are we going via Malta? Are we going via Sicily? You laugh, you see, but it's true. How else are the birds that are born here going to get back to West Africa? And when they disappear, the geese then arrive. And everything interrelates with everything else. And I take terrible sticks, it's hocus pocus, but it works.
But I read that you claim to be 90% accurate.
Yes.
With your predictions.
Yes.
And how do you validate that?
By giving my weather 6 months up front and then getting to come me 6 months later and say, well, how did I do? We're going to go through the field here. Because one day telleth another. And 1 month foretelleth another, and you just go along.
On your website, you've got a number of different folklore sayings, one of which is, in late August, when three kestrels fly, autumn will be dry. But why three? Why not four or one?
Well, because that, to me, everyone works. Everyone works. And it works very well, because if it's going to be a dry autumn, that means the kestrels have plenty of food.
Does that mean you need to see three simultaneously, or three throughout the day?
No, you will see three together. They will hunt together. And that'll most certainly be mother, father, and one of the chicks from that year's brood.
No, would you accept sort of fallibility in the reading of signs?
So you walked right by that, didn't you? That's a lord and lady plant, deadly poisonous to us. But quite a few birds will have a snaffle of that when they're hungry.
Do you accept any?
This plant here, excuse me.
It's all right.
That's a teasel plant. And during the winter, all the spiky bits are food for the chaffinches.
When the weather van points to gloomy, it's gotta be sunny to me when your eyes look into mine.
Now look, these are hawthorns. This is also food for all the birds, you see, but not so many again. So all the signs are for a very mild winter. Depend which way the wind blows on the 21st of December, which is a wind day, how cold the second half of the year is going to be. But at the moment, there's not too much snow forecast at all.
Why the 21st? Why such specific days?
Because that's a quarter day, and there are four quarter days in the year. That's where the wind blows on the 29th of September will be the predominant direction to the next quarter day, which is the 21st of December. And then that will be the predominant direction to the 21st of March.
Hello.
Hello. Hi.
David, could I ask you how your passion for predicting the weather began?
I was born in a little village called Yelverton between Plymouth and Princetown, and my uncles took me out and showed me the countryside. I used to go ferreting, and gradually you learn. Then I came up to London. And then I got into the police in London. And if you learn to read the sky and the weather, because if you went out without your coat in them days, you got wet and cold and you never came back in because there were no panda cars or anything. You got wet and cold, so you learn very quickly. You see, I was brought up in the police where you wrote everything down on day, date, time, place. I went to where I saw, who said, and it's detail. I'll just interrupt you one moment. The tree there is a lime tree. Now have a look at the colour of the leaf one side. Look at that.
That's beautiful.
There.
That's almost white.
Yes. That's just the way that nature's designed the leaf. So you look at it from one direction, it's white. As the trees up there, they're all lime trees. And you look at it from another direction and they're green.
So you really love this stuff, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Being able to look, see, interpret, and then see it come forth in times to come. Yeah, in the future. So you can look at something now and say, oh, in 6 months' time, that will happen. And that's that. Now, if you're a little bit further this way, coming through a stile onto a footpath.
You've got to watch your feet for the country pancakes here, haven't you? My dad was a maths teacher.
Yeah.
You know, I learned about algorithms and quadratic equations when I was a kid. Although we did come for walks in the... That's a green woodpecker, isn't it?
Yeah, green woodpecker. Yeah, they live in this row here. So I was taught this when I was at school because you used to go out. You had time to go out. You had time to go swimming lessons. You had time for PE. But they don't do it that way now because it's progressive. So
if you had your way in education, you'd be teaching children how to read the weather, how to read nature.
Yes. Do you know what they are?
No, I don't.
Slows. See, you only got two there. That's nothing, is it? And normally you're looking at 20 on that.
So the tree knows it's going to be a mild winter.
Yes, of course it does. No, you're catching on. This is good. See, and there's a heron just flown away. See, just out through the back. There, because there's a big pond here full of big carp. Yeah. You're staying here. Look at that tree. What do you see?
It's got some holes about the size of a cricket ball.
Yes.
Woodpeckers?
Yes.
In here is a green woodpecker's nest. Long vacated, I imagine.
Yes. The woodpeckers don't have their chicks till after May, beginning of June. And halfway through June, the wind swings from the east round to the southwest. So, the woodpecker doesn't want the rain coming on the southwesterly winds in the hole, do they? So the woodpecker's hole is always opposite the southwest, so it's facing east-northeast. So you see a tree, you'll find the woodpecker's nest is east-northeast. But it's all a part of meteorology and science, isn't it?
Well, I'm a big Sherlock Holmes fan, and this is what Sherlock Holmes
does. That's what Sherlock Holmes did, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's using what is there.
When you turn those heaters on, wow, is me. Got to put my cheaters on.
Okay, we're climbing over a lovely old rusty gate into another meadow, which is just by the
River Eden floodplain.
The River Eden floodplain.
We'll go across this field here, through the ancient gap, because that used to be an ancient trackway there, and across to the next field. A couple of crows there, see them? Oh, magpies. Now, magpies, they're the bane of the countryside because they kill the thrushes and the blackbirds. Oh, they're real murderers, they are.
It's a giant restaurant, isn't it, nature, as Douglas Adams once said.
And it's interconnected and interdependent. Tell me the weather in 16 weeks' time exactly. Bump. I can do that.
What can you tell us about the weather for September and October?
Oh, well, the first 2 weeks of September, the children go back to school, don't they? So it's bound to be fine and lovely. But apart from that, it's going to be a warm autumn, a really warm autumn, a wet Christmas. Depends what the wind does on the 21st of December. But we might get away with no snow this winter. We might.
As it's been widely accepted that the reading of weather is not an exact science because of the chaotic nature of weather, do you accept fallibility in your own readings as well?
Yes, that's why I only owe 90%. Not bad, is it?
Oh, those weepers, how they hypnotize. Where did you get those eyes? Jeep and creepers with your big black eyes.
David Bramwell out walking with natural weather forecaster David King. And Radio 3 would like to point out that we can't take any responsibility for predictions, though, well, it sounds like a mild winter to me. The producer of that interval piece was Sarah Jane Hall. Well, welcome back to tonight's debut prom by the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra. Under David Robinson, they are bringing us tonight a varied but very cleverly themed programme in which sometimes unlikely influences and admirations are revealed. We're going to hear Gershwin and Schoenberg in this half. Not likely bedfellows, you might think. One, the king of the American jazz age. The other, the acknowledged high priest of 20th century avant-garde. But you would be wrong, as David explained to me earlier.
Well, this programme, I suppose, really is connected up with two composers who became firm tennis partners in Los Angeles, Schoenberg and Gershwin. And partly, I think, because for Gershwin, who had come from popular music, the degree of sophistication and technical virtuosity that someone like Schoenberg was showing in his composition was something very attractive. And I think you hear in the American in Paris, following Schoenberg's really imaginative orchestra, just how much Gershwin was really working on the subtleties of orchestration. Many times when you hear American in Paris, it tends to be played just like a pop piece. And in fact, you can hear that Gershwin was such a deep musician, and that's something that Schoenberg recognized.
Well, first we're going to hear the Schoenberg, his five pieces for orchestra, his 1908 response to a tragic and tumultuous time in his private life at the heart of the Expressionist movement in Vienna. His wife had left him for a younger man, the artist Richard Gerstl, a rising star of the Expressionist movement. Schoenberg eventually convinced her to return with their children, but then Gerstl committed suicide. Well, it's hard not to link these events and the inevitable turmoil they provoked with the extreme emotional temperature, if you like, of Schoenberg's music in the years immediately afterwards. So, in the five pieces, we have each piece a kind of super condensed dramatic scene, and each of them seems to want to say so much, but without quite revealing what. We have the five pieces then. First, we have Premonitions, which introduces a sense of restless anxiety. Then, The Past, which opens with a solo cello whose wistfully expressive tone contrasts really strongly with the brutal force of the preceding movement. Then Colours, which is often cited as a study in orchestration, a musical kaleidoscope, if you like. Then Peripeteia, which is the turning point in ancient Greek drama, often occasioned by a character learning something of which he had previously been ignorant. Well, I think we can see where that all came from. And then the fifth piece is called the Obbligato Recitative. That title, it's elusive, isn't it? It conceals more than it reveals. Well, here comes David Robertson to conduct the St. Louis Symphony in Schoenberg's five pieces for orchestra.
The Obbligato Recitative, number 5 of Schoenberg's 5 pieces for orchestra, performed by the St. Louis Symphony, conducted by David Robertson. And that was the original orchestration, which Schoenberg wrote in 1908 for a large orchestra. He subsequently did rewrite it for a much smaller ensemble, but the version we heard tonight, with the mighty forces of the St. Louis Symphony, was as he had first intended it. David Robertson shaking the hand of David Halen before leaving the stage, returning in just a few moments to perform some Gershwin. He mentioned, didn't he, in that interview earlier, that Schoenberg was a great friend of the multi-talented, multifaceted, commercially successful, always popular George Gershwin. They were friends and neighbours in LA. They were tennis partners, they were chess buddies, and the very wealthy Gershwin sponsored some of Schoenberg's work. I found a marvellous film on YouTube of Schoenberg and various pals, which was shot by Gershwin himself, and you can see the tennis court in the background. It's really atmospheric, great fun to watch. Now, when it came to music, the two of them were, perhaps quite surprisingly, huge admirers of one another. Schoenberg wrote later about Gershwin, "I know he is an artist and a composer. He expressed musical ideas, and they were new, as is the way in which he expressed them." When you listen to the next piece, which is Gershwin's popular American in Paris, written in Europe and meant, as the title suggests, to tell the tale of a tourist in Montparnasse, just think of how much the two composers must have listened to each other's work and influenced each other's orchestration. Well, on the surface, an American in Paris is a really light piece. It's rather a fun piece for an American orchestra's debut performance here at the Proms, too. At its premiere, opinion was, well, it was mixed. Most people loved it, after all. It was Gershwin, they loved all his music. But some critics liked it, they called it happy and full of life. Others, though, hated it, calling it silly and long-winded. But let's be honest, it's nearly 90 years on, and it's still being played and enjoyed in concert halls around the world. I think Gershwin might be having the last laugh. He wrote the piece in the spring of 1928. He was travelling in Paris, meeting some of his heroes like Prokofiev and Ravel, Milo and Poulenc. The story goes that he asked Ravel for lessons in orchestration, and the older man refused, saying there was nothing that he could teach Gershwin that he hadn't already mastered. In his words, Gershwin wanted this orchestral work to portray the impressions of an American visitor in Paris as he strolls about the city and listens to the various street noises and absorbs the French atmosphere. There is a section as well, though, when clearly that American visitor gets rather homesick, and you can hear the American blues influence then to reflect that. But let us hear it now. Gershwin's American in Paris, David Robertson returning to the stage to hear, to conduct these Americans in London, the St. Louis Symphony. Thank you. Gershwin's An American in Paris, performed by the St. Louis Symphony under David Robertson at this, their debut prom. Their musical director, David Robertson, coming back to the stage now, climbing up the stairs to bring the percussion section to their feet. And indeed, they're getting a standing ovation from some people very near me. And then the extensive brass section. With special mention possibly going to the saxophonists, Nathan Nabb, J. Michael Holmes, and Adrienne Honnold. Leader, concertmaster David Halen taking a bow. And a minor change of personnel taking place now on the stage, with David Robertson bringing everybody to their feet to possibly mask that. But I suspect that after one American classic, we could be getting another as an encore. Not before another bow, though, from David Robertson, musical director of the St. Louis Symphony since 2005, principal guest conductor of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, and soon to be artistic director of the Sydney Symphony Orchestra too. This is a man who's going to collect a lot of air miles. He's back on stage, bringing the trumpet player Thomas Drake to his feet. Principal trombone Timothy Myers. And tuba player Michael Sanders. Clarinetist Diana Haskell, and now the whole gang on their feet. I think it's fair to say that Chaprom's audience have enjoyed this concert. David's now asking if they want an encore, and you heard the response. We'll be right back. is possible in this best of all possible worlds. What a great encore to choose for this debut prom by the St. Louis Symphony, the overture to Candide by Leonard Bernstein. Like I say, an American classic from some American visitors who proved very popular with the prom's audience this evening and who I'm sure will be warmly welcomed back. St. Louis Symphony, based in Missouri, doing extremely well with Grammys coming out of their ears under their musical director, David Robertson. And indeed, just a couple of years ago, a recording they made of John Adams' Dr. Atomic, a symphony was named Best CD of the Decade by the Times. And funnily enough, you can hear John Adams tomorrow here at the Proms conducting his work Nixon in China. Well, as David Robertson once again brings his orchestra, the St. Louis Symphony, to their feet, it is time, I'm afraid, for me to say goodnight and hand you back to John Shea in Broadcasting House. Good evening.
Katie, thank you very much. That was Katie Derham at the Royal Albert Hall. And as she said, we're back there tomorrow evening for a complete performance of an opera conducted by an American visitor and about an American visitor. It's John Adams' Nixon in China, with the composer himself conducting the BBC Symphony Orchestra. An earlier than usual start time, 7 o'clock tomorrow evening. And as you may know, John Adams is also our current Composer of the Week. So the third instalment of Donald MacLeod's series also has an earlier start time tomorrow evening of 6 o'clock. Now, a word from Petrarch Trelawney.
It might be a piece of music that you grew up with. Might be a piece of music you chose to be performed at your wedding or at a friend's party. Might be something taught to you by a beloved piano teacher. Perhaps the first piece of music you heard live in concert. Whatever it is, we'd like you to tell us about it on Your Call. Your Call is a daily part of breakfast on BBC Radio 3. It's very simple. We talk to listeners on the air, on the phone, just for a couple of minutes and get them to tell us why a particular piece of music is so special to them. What piece of music would you choose? We'd love to hear from you. Free breakfast at bbc.co.uk. Tell us the piece of music that you choose for Your Call and be part of breakfast 7 days a week here on BBC Radio 3.
And Petrarch will be back in this very, sitting in this very chair from 6:30 tomorrow morning. Well, next, this evening on Radio 3, another chance to hear one of our features from last year. The Guardian's dance critic, Judith McCrell, will be looking at the exciting future of the dance world in A Movement Beyond Dance. That's in just over 10 minutes from now, at 10 o'clock. It's followed by the second of this week's Radio 3 essays on the history of the music appreciation movement at 10:45. And then Max Reinhardt is here live at 11 o'clock with the first of this week's Late Junctions. So before Judith McCrell's programme at 10 o'clock, here's some more American music, South American this time. From a disc of Astor Piazzolla's music, arranged and played by Guidon Kremer and friends, this is Piazzolla's Concerto for Quintet. Thank you. Astor Piazzolla's Concerto for Quintet, arranged and played by Gidon Kremer, violin, Paul Mayer, clarinet, Vadim Sakharov, piano, Alois Posch, double bass, and Per Orne Glorvigen, bandoneon. This is BBC Radio 3. Stay tuned for our feature, which is coming next.
The 2012 BBC Proms season goes out with a bang. On the two nights before the last night, a pair of BBC Proms concerts with the Vienna Philharmonic and Bernard Haitink. Haydn, Strauss, Bruckner, and Beethoven's fourth piano concerto, played by Murray Pariah. The Vienna Philharmonic at the BBC Proms. Thursday and Friday nights at 7 and 7.30 on BBC Radio 3.
And that'll be presented by Martin Handley. The Radio 3 essay at 10.45 tonight in this series, the music historian Richard Witts continues to tell the story of the rise and fall of the music appreciation movement. That's the essay in 45 minutes. Now at 10 o'clock on Radio 3, it's time for this evening's feature, A Movement Beyond Dance. The Guardian critic Judith McCrell explores the explosion of activity in the world of dance that's creating one of the most exciting periods in the history of the art form. The programme contains material recorded at the 2010 Contemporary Dance Festival in Venice.
Whoa. This isn't something I'm normally asked to do as a critic. Whoops! I'm suspended from the ceiling and I'm trying to swing and clamber my way through this forest of hanging rings. I've never personally been on an assault course before. Whoa! Right, oh dear, I don't see a very convenient... Whoops! Ring to...
The Hayward Gallery might be one of London's most famous spaces for the visual arts, but recently it's had an exhibition called Move that doesn't so much invite spectators to look at the work, but to dance their way through it. I went along to try out the contribution of the acclaimed choreographer William Forsyth. It's an installation called The Fact of the Matter, which is basically created out of dozens of hanging gymnast rings. Forsyth challenges us to swing a kind of Tarzan-like route through these rings. And as I discovered, it's no way as easy as it looks.
Halfway through, I've just fallen off. I was overambitious in my reach. I had this huge gap between me and the next ring, and my upper arms were just beginning to go into spasm. You go through such a roller coaster set of physical experiences, from the kind of exhilaration of a good swing to the absolute terror of a bad swing, when you're feeling a sense of your weight and your balance, how to calibrate your body. So it's maybe not dance, but definitely choreography.
You're creating weird and wonderful shapes, and I think if it was put to a piece of music, it could look quite amazing.
Yeah, because it's like the rings create the choreographic rules for you, and you kind of become this impromptu dancer.
Yeah. Even the rings actually start to make noise as well when they clink together, so that could be the music.
I've just watched two girls achieve what I haven't managed to, and they've got from one end to the other without touching the floor. So was that more difficult than it looked?
At first, you try and do it in a swinging technique, just using your arms. You don't realise that actually you can just use the strength in your legs and your feet.
The man who created this, William Forsyth, calls it a choreographic object. Did you feel in any way that you were being set up as a dancer, that you were following some kind of rules, and that you were appearing in a kind of piece, performance piece?
When you've actually got the technique going, you feel a lot more graceful, more like a dancer than just some clumsy oaf.
There are some bad moments, aren't there, when you find your legs are going in completely opposite directions.
One of the higher rings hits you in the head, that's great.
Yeah, it's cheap.
She was more like a ballerina, I was more like a gladiator.
My fellow climbers were definitely engaging with Forsyth's rings as a choreographic idea. And I think that's because dance audiences now have become used to seeing movement as part of a wider spectrum of forms and activities, combining with digital art, visual installation, text, music, film. I would say that today's dance scene has become dazzlingly diverse, willing to engage with so many possibilities and ideas. And its impressive audience figures suggest that people don't mind these boundaries being blurred. But some of the work I see does feel very different to the dance I first fell in love with, dance that was all about these super articulate bodies, expressing through movement what words couldn't say. The idea that dance is just pure movement can seem a bit simple-minded now, but I can't actually believe it's ever going to become passé. Isn't dance always, at some level, going to be about the live human body moving through time and space? At the Hayward, I met up with Betsy Gregory, who's Artistic Director of Dance Umbrella, an international festival of contemporary dance that's held each year in London. Betsy also had a go on the demonic Forsyth rings. So how did she get on?
It didn't last very long. I thought that for safety's sake, I better get off.
I mean, you trained as a dancer, so did you feel that any of your known techniques of balance and coordination were coming into play?
Well, my dance career was a long time ago. For the small amount of time I did it, my skills were not very useful, I'm afraid.
But Forsyth has talked about setting up rules, making us move in certain ways. He's created a live moving installation. Is that dance? Can dance be anything we want it to be?
I once had to write a little essay when I was a student about what is dance and what is not dance. And I think I drew the conclusion that dance could be any organized, therefore choreographed, movement that was intended to be beautiful or watched or seen or participated in. The Forsyth rings are what I would call choreographic in that to animate them, a person has to move through them, and that's part of the intention or the choreography.
You've put together for Umbrella some fairly extreme work, I would say, in the last couple of years. There was the French dancer who was in duet with a mechanical digger, tango duet in a bathroom showroom, man performing on the pavement outside Liverpool Street Station. Do you think it's fair to say that maybe in the last 10 years, dance has really been spreading its boundaries farther and faster than before?
Yes, I do. Dance has become even more global than it was before. Dancers are traveling all over the world. There's been an enormous cross-fertilization. In terms of reaching further and farther in other dimensions, dancers and choreographers are playing with the whole idea of what's real and what's virtual, and we're getting to the point where the technology enables the performance, doesn't override or supersede it. And also, the cross-fertilization with other genres like visual arts and theater has actually always been taking place. It's only really now, in this country, that we're starting to see those crossings over in a major way and starting to realize that we're looking at works by artists and it doesn't actually matter whether it's dance or whether it's not dance.
I've come to Venice, which is a city of traders and tourists and mercenaries and merchants, and it's always stolen and accumulated its traditions from other cultures, and it seems absolutely natural that it should also be home to the famous Art Biennale, where it showcases the most extraordinary and outrageous art from around the globe, and also that for the last 7 years it should be host to the International Dance Festival. And likewise, this is a festival that takes in dance from around the globe and also showcases an incredible diversity of choreographers and styles. And it's quite significant, I think, that in the introduction to this year's programme, the director Ismail Evo wonders whether the term movement isn't now too narrow a definition for much of what he's programming here.
I think more and more, each festival should, beside of including names, good work, interesting work, intelligent work, curious work, have to space for different ideas, which maybe is not exactly my cup of tea, but it drops something else. And I think the moment for dance today is drop in the table something else, which somehow affects or confronts, because I think that there's no one track to follow any longer.
Given the range of approaches in dance now, I mean, highly conceptual dance, highly technological dance,
absolutely.
Are there some works in the dance festival that actually you sometimes wonder whether they should be in the art biennale?
Absolutely. All these type of revolutions from the last century, they just came from the sky like a spaceship. They were somehow, in what I said, people were contaminating themselves earlier enough. That's what I try to create now here in Venice. I think it's a moment of blank canvas. Let's take this blank canvas and drop different colors, different ideas, and give space not just for good or bad. This momentum or this ambient, this laboratory of being together.
One of the most extreme works in the Venice Festival was The Tempest, performed by the Samoan company Mau. This is part of its dark and really unsettling score. Its creator is Lemmy Ponifacio, a choreographer who's also a Samoan high chief. And his work occupies a place that's somewhere between dance, theatre and ritual. The Tempest is a very dreamlike production, and its traditional imagery has a very modern resonance. There's one dancer whose body is covered with a slick of oil, another winged figure who twitches and buckles like a wounded seabird, and there's an elderly man with the most amazing array of tattoos. These creatures all move incredibly slowly across the stage, and it feels as if we're being asked to contemplate them rather than make sense of them. I wanted to know what response Ponifacio expected from us.
I start with this idea when I make theatre that I am not there to show something. I'm trying to make you be. That's your title, human being.
Could you explain a little bit the elements of Tempest?
I think your questions, you're always asking me what things represent.
Yes.
I'm not an object person.
Yeah.
I like to mark the tension of space in order to support your own contemplation of your existence.
Although we don't look at it and say, oh, that's Samoan, there's elements of your tradition in the movement and the language.
No. I don't dip into my pocket and sprinkle Samoan dust to make it.
No.
Like you have a different accent from me when we speak English. So, you know, that's all it is. It's a very shallow difference that makes us interesting. But deep inside, we are the same. We have our same concern. We all die and we all love.
And the dancers you work with, some of them, am I right, are not trained dancers?
None of them have been to a dance school or drama school. But I don't look for that. That's much more interesting for me than to put a class of human beings on stage and say, okay, step right, left, center, whatever. Then it just becomes a sequence of organizing some fancy steps that are pleasing to watch. I don't so much participate in dance festivals because, I don't know, it's a different kind of engagement with what I make.
So to attach the label dance to your work can be misleading and confusing, do you think?
Well, it's an English word.
What word would you use?
I don't know. I just make things, and when I go out to make things, I don't think I'm making theatre or dance. I'm just making what I make. And so when people ask me about dance, it's a very odd thing, because then I have to reflect on the history of Western dance. I don't think about those things.
That was a pretty challenging interview because really all the terminology that I've assembled as a critic was inadequate in the face of what Lemmy Ponifacio believes he's doing. He doesn't think of it in terms of dance. He doesn't really even think of it in terms of theatre. And it's a real example of
where the dance scene is today, that, you know, Lemmy's partly saying, well, I don't even want to be in a dance festival, and yet it's hard to think of what other festival would accommodate him. And because he sees his work almost as a way of creating an act of community rather than communication between him and his audience, he makes someone like me redundant. He doesn't want any of the questions that I asked of his work. He doesn't want my interpretations. In a way, I'm getting between him and the audience, so he's putting me out of a job. I've just come out from seeing Glow. It's a piece by the Australian company Chunky Move, and I'm really excited by it because I've seen a lot of work that's played with digital technology, where there've been virtual dancers interacting with the live bodies, or where computers have been used to create a kind of set design. But I've never seen a work that's actually billed itself as a duet between a live dancer and a bit of video equipment, which is basically what Glow is. What it does is show you in an incredibly dramatic way how the dancer moves through space. Here, because the light is picking up every movement that she makes, it's as if she's painting in light as she's on the stage. So the trajectory of her movements, the expansion of her movements, it's all made visible in light, and you get a sense both of ecstasy when sometimes she's almost dancing through a light storm, and then real terror where the light seems to be almost engulfing her, or the shadow rather seems to be engulfing her. It's a very dramatic piece, surprisingly dramatic for something that's so dependent on technology.
My name is Christy Eyre. I'm a performer with Chunky Move.
So when you're performing Glow and it's just you and this video tracking system, what kind of relationship do you have with this light on you? Yeah. Is it like another dancer? Is it a projection of yourself?
It feels like a duet of light and movement for me, in a way, because the two are so interconnected, and sometimes as one, other times working independently, but really with a very strong marriage together throughout the work. So I really feel like sometimes the light is driving, sometimes the body is driving, and other times working really coherently together. So it's a very connected relationship.
And physically, is there a frustration doing this work? I mean, do you feel you're not using all the range of your skills?
Absolutely not. If anything, it's completely the opposite. I've found working with this system really liberating, because the dancer is basically in control, because the light and sound is often following your tempo, and whilst the choreography is set completely and is the same whoever performs it, the actual kind of time that you can sit in things and exactly where you need to be within that confined space is really up to you. So for the first time in my career, the performer is in control, so it's really nice.
Gideon Obazanik, who's the director and choreographer of Chunky Move, has just taken us through the theatre where his company is performing, and there's a rehearsal going on. It's very intense, and we go into this extraordinary garden, which is very, very rare in Venice, incredibly green, birds singing, and Gideon's taking a well-earned bit of break in the daylight.
There's a long history of dance using various forms of technology at hand, certainly throughout the 20th century. Fly system, you know, conventional theatre that brings things in and out, lights that turn on and off, microphones that enhance the volume of people's voice. You know, these are just forms of technology to create work with. I think what's interesting with Glow in particular is that it's actually a very human work. And while the images are spectacular and you appreciate how it connects to the body, that's very quickly understood. But what we've really tried to do is really bring out the person who's dancing. And this has been very effective.
There's all these possibilities now of having virtual figures moving with live bodies, of 3D projection, video animation. Do you think there's a danger that we'll lose touch with the flesh and blood power of dance?
I think we already have in many ways lost touch with live performance. A lot of audiences that I deal with, particularly young audiences, their experience of live performance is very small. Some of them none whatsoever. The people's large experiences with screen, whether it be telephones, computers, cinema, television. So the live experience is quite small in the sort of contemporary world. And I work in live performance. For me, it's all about why does this have to be live? The liveness of it, people coming together in the same space, witnessing something, it becomes kind of an event.
When you come to a dance performance, what always strikes me is that the people on stage are actually doing the thing they're doing right there and right then, physically.
Alistair Spalding, artistic director at the Sadler's Wells Theatre in London.
There's no kind of pretense, there's no CGI, there's no tricks. It's absolutely real. And I think there's something in that. You can either do it or you can't do it. And it's a very kind of testing art form. You're there, you're under scrutiny, and you either amaze or you don't. And I think that's great. I think that's one of the greatest strengths of the form. It's very old-fashioned in a way, but I think people respond to that.
With Glow, it's very much about that live situation. And the great thing about this technology is it responds to the dancer, both the sound and the lights. So no performance is ever the same.